Well, that didn't last long. The two-game winning streak comes to an end with an absolute thud last night, a 5-2 loss to the New Jersey Devils, a team we knew that was significantly quicker than the Vancouver Canucks, and that showed every time the Canucks made a mistake. And here we are again, looking up. The mountain looks bigger. The sky's falling. Well, maybe not falling. Two more home games to go here before they get back out on the road. But home, road, doesn't really matter. The Canucks are in a world of hurt on our latest episode of the VanCast. Farhan Lalji, Harmon Dial. Harm, when I watched last night's game, the first period, I didn't hate. You know, like I thought they actually did some good things in terms of controlling shots, controlling scoring chances against a team that was the best shot-generating team in the NHL and a team that gave up the fewest shots in the league per game coming into that game. The first period, there were some good things, but sure enough, they're down 2-0. And then it just kind of escalated from there.
Definitely. And you mentioned that first period where they actually started pretty strong. And I 100% concur with you there. And in fact, that's kind of the crux of the issue, where you can't have a period like that and still be down 2 goals against a team like the New Jersey Devils, because defensively, that period went about as well as it could have. As you mentioned, New Jersey's a shot-generating juggernaut. They burn teams off of the rush. They burn teams in transition. And I was worried about that matchup a little bit, just because I was looking at some of the numbers Bryce Salvador, who's a Devils analyst for MSG, former player, of course, had. And the Canucks, going into that game, were 31st in terms of controlled entries against. So you pit New Jersey's speed game against Vancouver and how they defend the rush on the back end, and it could have been a nightmare really quickly. And the Canucks held their own really well. I mean, Jack Hughes, for example, they really kept him at bay, only 6 shots allowed at 5-on-5. They had more zone time, they had more possession, they seemed to be applying pressure, and yet you just can't afford to be down 2 goals after a period like that. And you look at the individual mistakes, and kind of reminiscent of earlier parts of the season, where that hooking penalty by Tanner Pearson, inexcusable to do that in the offensive zone. And from a veteran like that, you expect better, especially when the team's already climbing uphill. And then as soon as he's in the box, they lose the draw, and it's a classic Canucks PK, right? Miller and Horvat aren't in great positions. The first seam pass gets through because of that. And then Myers is kind of drifting high, and he allows that backdoor play to Nico Hischier, and it's already 1-0. And even beyond just the first goal, right? You could have lived with the first PK goal. You're still kind of in it. Once they got that second goal, that was the backbreaker at the end of the first period, because you know at that point, down multiple goals with the team playing the way it kind of has been this season, that was a massive mountain to kind of climb, especially deflating, again, because you knew New Jersey wasn't going to be that listless offensively at 5-on-5 the entire game. And I think that just kind of highlights the difference between these two teams, and really the Canucks' issue the whole season is, you look at the Devils and they kind of struggled in that first period. They were able to weather the storm when the Canucks were kind of pushing offensively. The bend don't break. The Canucks, meanwhile, it's like they have zero resilience, where not only did they dig themselves a hole even when they were playing well, but you just knew in that second period, for example, when the Devils pushed, it was inevitable that the Canucks collapsed, and they just didn't have that composure. And of course, Demko hasn't been sharp enough to bail them out. That 10 minutes they had against Pittsburgh in the first part of the third period, that's the only time this season when it's felt like the opposition's pushed and the Canucks have somehow lived to fight another day. And I think that's a really, really concerning trend.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And for me, like, puck management and game sense are controllable elements to a game, right? Like, you can't control the fact that the Devils are just that much faster, right? And you talked about, you know, the gap between these two teams. How about the gap between the Canucks and a lot of teams, right, that they face on a nightly basis? But there are controllable things. So you talk about the just completely ridiculous, soft, careless penalty by Tanner Pearson, who's normally not that guy, right? In terms of common sense issues, Tanner Pearson is the least you've got to worry about for the Canucks, right? Like when we talk about turnovers and JT Miller and, you know, and other players who just have poor puck management skills, like Tanner Pearson's not that guy, but he does that in that game. Whatever it is, it's catching, and you know the Canucks can't kill a penalty. Then the next goal, bad rebound by Thatcher Demko. Now, he had no chance on four of the goals that went in with the goaltender, but that one, he's got to eat that rebound. Podkolzin, in the second period, the turnover late in the penalty leads to a shorthanded goal. And then which it was a two-on-one. And then you get that easy stretch pass where it looked like Oliver Ekman-Larsson made a bad read, but just they're on cruise control in transition through the neutral zone. The Canucks gave up the middle of the ice all the time in this game and leads to another two-on-one and no chance. And on both two-on-ones, on goals 3 and 4, do the Canuck defensemen, like, have they not played minor hockey at any point in their life where their minor hockey coach told them, you have to take away the pass and let the goaltender deal to shoot? Like, have they never been taught that? In minor hockey or in any level, like I know, I was at the rinks with my son when he was, you know, he played minor hockey up until last year, and the defensemen on his team were taught that on a 2-on-1, you take away the pass.
Well, Farhan,
right? Like, what are they doing?
It's just really funny to me because my brain's been so conditioned to where when the Canucks do have a defensive breakdown and it's a 3-on-1 or it's a 2-on-1. It's just conditioned to where it's normal for it to get across. So there was, in the first period, Connor Garland and his line had a 3-on-1 rush. And it's like my brain was completely baffled when the Devils actually broke the pass up. I was like, wait, what? This is possible? You could actually break up a chance even when you're in trouble?
They are so not close to being defended properly. Like, these are groin-tearing goals that Thatcher Demko is trying to stop. Like, he's got it. Like, he's going to tear his groin trying to come across while the entire net is wide open. Like, just awful. And then even on the empty net goal, JT Miller turnover. Did you see JT Miller after he turned the puck over?
No, I missed it.
He didn't move. Go watch it again. And look, this is not a JT Miller effort because in his mind, I've just given up the game on an empty net goal, which he did. Right? Like, I mean, they weren't coming back to win anyway in that moment, but he turned it over and he did not take a step. He still was in the opposition end when the puck went in the net, bent over in that, shit, I did it again pose. Go look at it. It's almost comical. And this isn't a criticism of a lack of effort by JT Miller on the back check. It was I just spilled it. I just gave up any slim chance we had of getting another goal. Right? And it was like when you could see it in the body language, you can see it at key times in this game. You could hear it in Quinn Hughes' post-game comments where he talks about, you know, we're all trying to figure out what's wrong right now. You know, and he kind of explained the first goal. And then and then after that, he was kind of at a loss for words with his comments. And Bruce Boudreau after the game just talked about his frustration with the lack of consistency, how they defended the 2-on-1 or 2-on-1s, plural. Right. And so, you know, that fragility is going to take a long time to get out of this team. And it's not two games that's going to do it. Right. Their habits, their muscle memory, if you believe in that concept or not, I certainly do. It's going to take a long time for them to get out of this. And it's difficult, right? Like, we talk about it in football a lot, that certain teams have certain deficiencies. So they better find a way to play from ahead. Because if they don't play from ahead, you know, the other team can run the football and they can control the tempo and all of that kind of stuff. And you just can't fix it, right? We're talking about that with the Lions on Sunday. That they better get from ahead because they can't run defend. And there's certain things that you just can't do. And from a Canucks standpoint, they have to play from ahead because they're so fragile when anything bad happens to them. And their habits at their core are just so poor. It's going to take such a long run of success for them to actually think, this is how we now play. Whereas now when they get a two-game stretch where they can find ways to win games, it is an anomaly. And they know that a second they make a mistake and it ends up in the back of their net, this is who we are. And this is how we play. And here we go again. And that's the tough part, right? Like, it's a tough way to live. It takes so long to fix something and to build something. And it takes a minute to tear it down. And for the Canucks, it got torn down by a bad penalty. It got torn down by a bad rebound. It got torn, like just one after the other. It just got stacked so quickly against a team that, even though the Canucks contained them, I mean, you look at that first period, that Elias Pettersson line, we want to call it the second line. It's the first line in terms of actual generation. Like, I thought they were outstanding in the first period, right? But all of a sudden, they leave the first period down 2-0, and then you really don't notice them as much the rest of the game because they just fall into the muck with everybody else, right? You just see it on so many levels with this team that it becomes difficult to watch because you can see the storyline early in the game processing.
Definitely. And even when the Canucks started to mount a push, and this is where it's the difference being able to handle pressure, is when the Canucks got the first one with Horvat, and then he also drew the penalty. Such a valiant effort from him, by the way, trying to drag this team and pick them up. The Canucks had that power play late in the second, and I'm thinking in my mind, if they score here, they're going to make this really interesting in terms of you're within two goals, going into that dressing room, you've picked up momentum, and in this league, a two-goal deficit, trying to erase that in the third period, it's not hard at all. Especially when you think back to the second half of last season under Boudreau, the Canucks had a lot of third period comebacks. So especially coming off of a couple wins, it would have been plausible for this team to get back into it if they scored on that late power play in the second. But that's the difference, right? The Devils were able to handle that adversity where the Canucks actually won that draw and were starting to get some decent zone time off that power play. But the Canucks healed a couple of their shots and a couple of their chances. And once the Canucks made their mistake, the Devils were right back applying pressure. And I think they had multiple odd man rushes off against the Canucks' power play. And that was that in terms of you handle that two or three minutes of Vancouver's push, you're able to show that resiliency. And that was enough to kind of clinch the game right then and there. And the other thing I want to point out, and we've mentioned this before, but I just couldn't help but notice it again after the Canucks' the first goal they surrendered. JT Miller has now been on the ice, and I don't want to rag on him. It's not his fault that he's kind of being deployed in a position that isn't best suited to the strengths of his game, but he's now been on the ice for 8 goals in less than 15 PK minutes. That's a goal against for every 111 seconds. He's just, and again, it's not his fault. It's just not a strength of his game to make defensive reads, to take away the cross-seam passes. I just don't understand why he's still a first-choice penalty killer. The results since he's joined the team in 2019-20 are really bad in terms of how high the goals against are. And there's just got to be some type of adjustment there, especially because you can't even use the excuse now where in other circumstances, you may say, well, you need him to win the draw. Well, you had Horvat out to win the draw and he's your best faceoff man. So you didn't need Miller out in that situation as your first choice penalty killer against the Devils' top unit power play. So that's another little detail too, where deployment wise, if you're Bruce Boudreau, I would have liked to see a better adjustment.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. Before we end this segment and go to break, I want to talk about Myers and OEL, right? And we'll get into the newcomers in a second, but I just want to say this for context, that Quinn Hughes is back in the game, or back in the lineup, and you've got Ethan Bear that you've now deployed, so you don't necessarily have to lean on OEL and Myers for the minutes you had to at various times when Hughes was hurt and they hadn't made some additions on the back end, because we saw OEL play like 27 minutes and we've talked about how slow he looks this season. And I don't know if injury fatigue, anything is leading to that, but I've liked Myers this season for the most part, right? And I think last year he kind of turned the corner a bit. Not that he's a $6 million player, but he's an important piece for this team, based on not just salary, but effectiveness, right? He does some good things, but watching them last night, like, my goodness, do they look washed up?
It was bad. It's especially with OEL is the biggest concern to me, especially because he's the one that has been healthy for the entire part of the season. Myers obviously came back from injury, but also because he signed long term. He signed forever. I'm going to be in my
You're going to be in your 30s. Say it.
I'm probably going to be in my 30s by the time the contract expires.
Late 20s.
Actually, yeah, late 20s. I was like, I had to stop myself there. I was like, to get to my 30s, I got to wait till the Miller contract expires.
Oh,
which that's
wow.
actually a thing. I'm going to be in my 30s by the time JT Miller's still on this hockey team.
When I'm in my 70s and you're in your 30s, I'm going to be laughing at you still covering a team that hasn't won the Stanley Cup, for the record.
But I mean, yeah, I'm really concerned watching him play. There's zero dynamic qualities with his skating. And because of that, it affects him offensively, where rarely do you see him active and jumping up into the play offensively as sort of the trailer or the fourth man taking ice. And that's a really important part of creating offense in the modern NHL, is you need multiple guys that can do that. You need, for like, Calgary has Erasmus Anderson, they have Mackenzie Weegar, they have Noah Hannafin, guys who can consistently jump up in the rush, and the Canucks just don't have that. And that's part of the reason that's why they're not able to create a lot in transition, is it's not just, well, the D can't move the puck out of the defensive zone and the forwards aren't able to pick up the puck in the neutral zone where they're able to generate some speed, but they also don't have the defensemen able to join, which helps create those odd man scenarios, those 3-on-2s, those 4-on-3 situations. And even beyond the offense, man, OEL has had a lot of situations where he's been torched off the rush. Even in the Pittsburgh game, where the team played pretty solid as a whole, and I thought OEL had some decent moments, there were a couple moments where I was like, wow, in terms of him getting turnstiled off the rush, getting just spun around in opposing forwards, puck carriers just able to carve their way past him off the rush. And of course, on the goal where Boqvist had the assist, you alluded to it. I don't know what he's doing on that read. It's elementary that you defend between the dots off the rush. For whatever reason, OEL made the read to kind of spray wide, and Boqvist had a ton of space, and he kind of left Myers out on an island to defend the 2-on-1. On the PK, he's been on the ice for 7 PK goals against, which is the most of any defender on the team. The results at 5-on-5, the Canucks have been outscored 9-5 in his minutes. And defensively, there's an issue where when opposing teams dump the puck in, and you don't notice it in terms of obvious mistakes just because he never gets the puck in the first place, OEL just isn't winning enough races to secure defensive zone retrievals, which are necessary to get the puck going the other way. And you don't notice them as like, oh, that's a turnover. They don't stick out as glaring mistakes because it's just a forechecker retrieving the puck first. It doesn't stand out to you. But though the aggregation of those little plays results in more time in your own end. And I mean, forget the contract. Through these first 10 games, what's he bringing to the table right now, period? He's not retrieving the puck. He's not able to defend the rush. So outside of some moments here and there where he's able to make defensive stops, he hasn't been reliable enough in his own end. And there's nothing there offensively. I mean, Bruce Boudreau was scratching Garland early in the year and Nils Höglander. If you want to hold players accountable for their performance, I would sit OEL for a game and play Kyle Burrows on the left side. This is a team that was supposed to make the playoffs. They're 2-6-2. You got to wake the team up somehow. And
yeah, but in terms of OEL, right? Like when you scratch Garland, which I think was a mistake, but when you scratch certain players, it's generally because of effort or carelessness or controllable things. I don't know that Ekman-Larsson can control who he is right now. Like I know we were expecting when they traded for him that, okay, look, if they can get through 3 years of this deal and we can see a little bit of an uptick, right, in his performance in a new environment, and the environment clearly hasn't been better. Yeah, there's more fans and media, but I don't know, the media makes it better, and certainly the team around him isn't necessarily better, right? So, you know, it's been a more hockey-driven and focused environment, but it hasn't necessarily been a better one that's conducive to his success. We did see a bit of an uptick the first year, and now we're just seeing it, like, fall. Well,
maybe
off
a reset could help him, because I mean, I think back to the season opener against Edmonton. He was the only guy not taking morning skate. He needed a maintenance before the season even started. And I believe he took another maintenance day recently. So, I mean, is there something nagging there? Is he fully fit? Maybe he's just eaten a lot of minutes and he's tired. Like, I don't know if it's one of, if it's something like that. Because if it is, then maybe you give him a game to just kind of heal. Again, I don't think the Canucks will actually do that. Because as you kind of mentioned, it isn't necessarily an effort thing. I see him kind of battling and working his tail off. The performance just isn't there. But on merit right now, it's also, and this is, you know, maybe separate to OEL, but I don't know how you look at Kyle Burrows' performance so far this season and the way he works his ass off and think to yourself, how could he be sitting right now?
Yeah, I have a tough, you know how I feel about Jack Rathbone, but in terms of guys that have actually earned everything as opposed to somebody they need to just give an opportunity to, like, yeah, for sure, Kyle Burrows has earned a top six role with this team. We'll stay on the D and talk a bit about the newcomers and much more when we come back.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, so Harm, as we talk about Ekman-Larsson and the D and deployment and all of this, I mean, last night I thought he'd play more than he did only because Luke Shen got ejected from this game and Shen only played 901. But I think because the fact they were as behind as they did, and maybe Boudreau saw the writing on the wall, that he didn't necessarily load up. But Quinn Hughes, 26-10 in his first game back, and we'll talk about what that looked like in a moment. Ekman-Larsson, 21-27, which is still a lot, but when he was playing 26.5 the other night, certainly a lot less than that. They were barely killing penalties, so he didn't have those tough minutes. Tyler Myers, 19-17, and then fairly solid and even deployment for Stillman and Bear, who played just over 18 minutes. But Quinn Hughes, 26-10. And I bring this up because prior to his injury, you know, I was clear. Everybody knew it was pretty obvious. Like, something is not happening with Quinn Hughes right now. He's not been good enough. He's not been dynamic enough. Defensively, his game was trending to what we saw 2 years ago, as opposed to the improved defensive play we saw last year. So ultimately, he's injured. And so we attribute what happened in those early games prior to the injury to the injury, right? That maybe he, you know, it's not just that he's defensively deficient right now or that he's regressing. It's that there's actually an injury. And maybe there's something to that with Ekman-Larsson. We're not going to know until he gets a break, which it clearly looks like he needs. But if it's just age, you know, now they're in trouble, right? Like, if there's no actual answer, then they're going to be stuck with this for the season, because you know he works hard and you know that it's not a lack of conditioning and effort in the offseason to get to where he needs to be. So I'm almost hopeful at some point there's an injury, because that would at least give us an explanation and maybe a chance for Rathbone to get in, which has certainly been my comfort food. But Quinn Hughes, 26-10, and he didn't look any better. I'm not going to lie to you. Now, 4.5 minutes of that was power play time, but didn't look overly dynamic on the power play, you know, in terms of his ability to carry the puck through the neutral zone and be a one-man entry machine, which the best of Quinn Hughes looks like. And certainly, you know, he wasn't as defensively flawed as he was pre-injury, but he just didn't have the puck and didn't look as dynamic. And then he's playing 26-10, which just makes me wonder how this is going to get better, right? Because if he's hurt, which is why he struggled, and now he's not hurt, but he's still playing like this, or maybe he's still hurt, but they've got to roll him out there because they're desperate. It's got to be one or some combination of all of that, because I expected a little more from Quinn Hughes, especially with his brother on the other side.
Yeah, I think first game back, especially, I expected a little bit of rust, and I think it'll take him a bit of time to find his groove. I thought he looked
pretty...
He hasn't
been out that long, though. Come on.
No, well, even just...
talking about a guy that's missed weeks and weeks.
Sure, that's true. I'm just talking overall when you're... presumably, the further you get away from your injury, the more you can obviously hopefully improve and get closer to feeling 100%. I actually thought in the defensive zone with his exits, Hughes looked pretty evasive. I saw him in the first period and I was like, okay, that's pretty decent. He shook off Nico Hischier on one breakout, and I was like, all right, he's skating a little bit better. But you're right, offensively, there was not nearly enough, especially on the power play. He looked off to me. I remember there was, I want to say it was a second period power play, but there was one play where he kind of hesitated with the puck at the point in terms of making the next play, the next pass. And then from way far out, he just kind of flicked a wrister on net that wasn't even close, and it kind of killed the possession. I was like, that's not Quinn Hughes. And even on the rebound goal, the one where Pearson was kind of back and playing defense as well, Hughes should have had the box out in terms of that rebound. And yeah, Demko, ideal world, he kicks that rebound out somewhere else. But Hughes is also completely on the wrong side. So I'm with you in the sense that they still need more out of him. It's just a tough spot to kind of be in, because that's where when you demand and rely so much on your number one guy and you don't have much help around him, whether it be in terms of his partner, other players on the team that can step up, other defensemen that can take on a little bit more minutes, and maybe you have him closer to the 22, 23 minute mark while he's kind of getting back up to speed. That's where it can help to be insulated, and he obviously doesn't have that insulation right now. It's kind of being thrown into the fire, and it wasn't good enough against the Devils. Again, the silver lining, I think, is just he at least looked a lot better breaking the puck out.
Yeah, he did. But like I feel like you sat him out because of an injury, and you better be sure he's 100%. Like you've won two games without him. And if he wasn't 100%, like I would rather have him get that much closer to full health than be thrown out there a little bit early. And again, maybe he's not healthy. Maybe there's still a lot that he's got to work on. But 26-10 felt like a lot. He was minus two. And again, 4.5 minutes of his ice time was 5-on-5 play. But they need him to be at another level. And I'm not saying he won't get there. You know, like last year when Pettersson struggled and I was critical, I never thought he was washed. Right now, Thatcher Demko is struggling. I certainly don't believe he's washed. I believe he's going to get his game back, and I believe Quinn Hughes is going to get his game back. But they need him to be able to control play the way he did previously if this team is going to have any semblance of success or be able to claw their way back into anything. I don't even know what my expectations are for them to get back to at this point. But if they expect to improve, Quinn Hughes has got to be a significant part of that, along
and
with the
speaking
goaltender.
Speaking of Hughes, I mean, I just couldn't watch that Devils game without thinking, man, would John Marino have looked really good next to Quinn Hughes if he went out and acquired him. I mean, I just, for a Canucks team that for the last few summers has been so desperate to kind of find that top four right-handed young defenseman, and it's so rare for them to be affordably available on the market, and finally you have a young legit top four RD locked up on a reasonable contract, fits the age of this core, who's actually affordable on the trade market. It only cost a second round pick and Ty Smith, who Smith's I think toiling around in the minors right now, the second, by the way, which you had already dumped to get rid of Jason Dickinson right before the start of the season. I just can't understand how the Canucks didn't carve out the cap space and assets necessary to fill a need like that, right? Marino wouldn't have been a stopgap. He's a legit core piece. He defends the rush well. He can move the puck. He'd be perfect as kind of like the stay-at-home presence who can also help transitionally alongside of Quinn Hughes. And that would have been a ball. That'd be a baller first pair. Hughes, Marino. And I just can't help but think, I mean, Devils fans are already taking victory laps about it online. His two-way numbers are off the charts good this season. Devils have outscored teams 8-2 with him on the ice at 5-on-5. And you knew he'd be available. I mean, I wrote a whole article in the offseason on why he'd be a good fit here. It's not as if he was available last minute and you're scrambling and you don't have enough time to carve out the flexibility. You knew long in advance. And from what I heard, the Canucks did kick tires and the price it would have taken wasn't unreasonable by any means. So that was one other note, especially when he made that gorgeous stretch pass for, I believe it was a secondary assist on one of the goals was you just can't squander opportunities like that when they so rarely come up.
Yeah, you're right. One opportunity they did take advantage of was Ethan Bear, who played over 18 minutes last night. What'd you think of his play?
I liked him. I thought he was really solid. There was one play in the first period that really stood out to me where Jack Hughes was picking up speed in the neutral zone. One of the most dynamic players in the NHL, can absolutely torch most NHL defensemen off the rush. And Bear played the angle really well, matched his pace because of the mobility Bear has, and he knocked the puck off Hughes' stick. And I was like, wow, I don't know how many guys...
That's what that looks like.
Yeah, I don't know how many other defensemen on the team can do that. So right off the bat, that was a really encouraging sign. I thought he passed the puck pretty well. And overall, I just thought it was a really solid outing. He was by far their best right-handed defenseman, I thought, last night. And he may be their best RD this season if Myers doesn't pick up the slack. So watching Bear play and that trade as a whole, I think that was, for fifth round pick, I mean, you roll that dice any day. That could be a potential potential steal if he's a solid number 4 or 5 guy for you moving forward. Certainly with the way Bear played in Edmonton, maybe he can hold down top 4 role for you in a pinch. And I really liked his game. And that is definitely one of the bright spots coming out of the game against the Devils was his composure and his two-way upside, where his speed just adds something different on the right side, not only defending the rush, but also being able to win races for defensive zone retrievals and sort of handle that pressure and make little bump passes to help the team kind of have a little bit more possession. That's something that the right side doesn't have enough of. So really get to see the impact he made last night.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that play against Hughes really stood out to me as well. And just kind of the calm and timing, which when it's your first game of the season, you don't expect him to have, right? Like you expect him to turn late or, you know, just be off in his gap. Like just you'd expect some of it to just be wrong. But I thought he looked really, really comfortable. You can tell he was motivated. You could tell he was prepared. The extra work that he did, which he said, you know, it sucks getting bag skated all the time, but he didn't look like he faded through 18 minutes. They didn't look like they had to protect him and shelter him or anything like that. Like, I don't know. I thought the early returns on him were pretty good. And if they can get some of their other guys, like you said, that are that they're expecting more from, that they're paying more to, that they've got more invested in, if they can just get a medium watermark performance out of them, they may have something. It obviously was tough last night once Luke Schenn got tossed early in the second period there. But I want to see what it looks like when they're all available, right? And, you know, is there a place now, like you said, Kyle Burrows should be in that top 6, in my opinion. What happens when Travis Dermott becomes available? You know, I don't think we're going to see Tucker Pullman anytime soon, if at all, again this year, but that's going to be a long-term situation. I know that they're hopeful that they can get Dermott back sooner than later. What's it, you know, like, is there anything there when they're all there, or is it still just a bunch of bottom pairing players masquerading as top 4 guys?
Well, it can be passable, but that logic requires OEL and Myers to sustain the level of play that they had last season, where that pair was a key part of the resurgence they had under Boudreau in solidifying the team's 5-on-5 play, because they were kind of able to handle these difficult matchups against top lines, and they were only slightly underwater in terms of controlling shots, chances, goals. They were just steady. They soaked up huge minutes, and it kind of just created a sturdy enough foundation and backbone for the team at 5-on-5 to where it would allow their special teams, and specifically the power play, to be the difference maker and help them win hockey games. And so that's, to me, is still the biggest key, because, yeah, I mean, Quinn Hughes at some point is going to start looking like his elite self again. And if you can get more from OEL and Myers, and then you add Bear into the equation, and you have enough sort of bodies to where, with the available personnel, you can definitely scrap together a decent third pair, there could be enough for the blue line to, again, be passable, to be at a point where it isn't killing you. The bigger concern I have, even more than the defense, is I'm looking at this team and they're struggling to create even strength offense. And again, part of that is because the defensemen don't add enough punch from the back end.
Okay, well, we'll dive into that. Let's take a break. I do want to get into that, their lack of even strength offense overall. We've talked about Bears, one of their newcomers, Jack Stidnica, also in the game as a third line center. We'll get into him. And Bo Horvat on a roll, regardless of whether or not his power play goals or not, with the contract hanging over him, he certainly isn't letting that affect him that more when the VanCast returns. So before we get into the offense, Harm, let's finish up on the newcomers and talk a bit about Jack Stidnica, who got an opportunity as the Canucks' third line center last night. 23-year-old right shot coming over from Boston. What were your thoughts on his early returns? Didn't play a lot, right? I mean, ultimately played 9.5 minutes, or just over 9 minutes, I should say. Was a minus one, couple of hits in the game, but didn't necessarily get a lot of run last night.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty quiet outing. Obviously, I'm not going to be quick to judge a guy after one game, but in terms of what I liked, I think his pace and his wheels were definitely, I don't know if impressive is the right word. I don't think it was that great, but I liked it. I liked how he was kind of closing pucks in the offensive zone. I liked his overall work rate, and I think there is something in terms of his physical attributes. Not necessarily in terms of throwing hits, but the kind of pace that he has, you couple that with kind of the energy that I saw, and that helped him, I think, pursue the puck pretty well. With it, once that line kind of had possession, I didn't necessarily like what I saw. I thought there were a couple moments where Stidnica turned pucks over. Again, nothing egregious, but there were moments where I was like, okay, maybe he's going to make a play, and maybe it was a situation where his line mates didn't give him enough support, but he did give possession back up. I think that's where his reads and kind of his decision making going back to his time in Boston were a little bit of a yellow flag, and that's where you talk to people that have studied Stidnica's game a lot, people who were familiar with him with the Bruins, and kind of tracks the overall assessment of he's got a good work rate, he's got decent wheels. In the offensive zone, he can find the right spots to create space for himself when he doesn't have the puck, and he can get open. And when he does get open and someone can get him the puck, he has a pretty good shot. But he's not going to be the one that drives a line. He needs someone who can kind of get him the puck. He probably needs to fit next to a playmaker to have offensive success, at least. And I think we saw a lot of those elements, both positive and in terms of areas where he needs some insulation to have success. Overall, I like the trade personally. I didn't mind it in the sense where, yeah, it sucked to give up Myron Berg, who anytime you have an RD with maybe some type of upside, the Canucks could have definitely used a piece like that, but Myron Berg was still a real long shot to make it in the NHL. And Stidnica, his AHL scoring rates have been pretty impressive. And there's enough track record there. And especially as a right shot center, I mean, the team's center position down the middle long term is also kind of a question mark, because Miller may be better off as a winger than he is as a center. And Horvat's a UFA.
Maybe, huh?
I'm trying to give him some slack. I don't want to bag the guy all
the
time.
Dude, you're going
to
be in your 30s when his contract expires. yeah, look, and that is the problem, right? Like, that position, really quickly, we're going to spend more time talking about 3C than we do about what their defense looks like if they ever get everybody back healthy. And like you said, if they wind up treading water, because that becomes an issue now. Because now Lazar's out of the lineup, but, you know, I think generally the thought was he would be a fourth line center, whether it's him or Oman, both of them can play in the middle, but both of them are probably better suited for a fourth line role than necessarily jumping up into a third line role at this point. So they're going to look at that, and that's going to be an organizational need, a Canuck need, all of it. It's going to be a challenge, right? And you can't hide that. And ultimately, I know the club is hopeful that as JT Miller kind of makes a knot in the rope and hangs on a little bit defensively and just kind of gets more comfortable in his own end by playing the wing that eventually they can move him back to center. I know that's a hope that the book has not been closed. The door has not been closed on him potentially being a center, but you know, when you put him back there, you're going to be holding your breath. Right. And certainly on a number of levels, because, you know, you wanted a guy there that had a little bit of offensive pop because of how their wingers are constructed, right? Because they naturally have a little more of an offensive bent. You want to have a facilitator that could potentially be there, you know, playing in the middle with them, right? So it's a concern on a few different levels in terms of how much you can get out of your wingers if you've just got a guy there killing time. So we'll see what it looks like. And look, Stadnica, it's his first game. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater quite yet, but he's going to have to take a step in some of those areas because it's not like they don't have enough forwards that struggle to make reads right now. They can't add another to that mix.
Yeah, it's, again, we'll 100% going to give him time. And like I said, I didn't hate the trade at all. No. There's potential there. And I mean, if he hits, I mean, best case scenario, yeah, he could sort of like give you some 3C minutes that I don't think you would otherwise be able to get from other parts of the roster if Miller's still on the wing.
Bo Horvat, meanwhile, is like among the league leaders in goals, even though a lot of his damage has been done on the power play. But the captain standing up, right? Like he's doing his part right now.
Definitely. And he, like one thing I've really liked about him and I've noticed about him over the years is he steps up when the team kind of like most desperately needs it. I think back to, for example, and of course it's just been unfortunate that the rest of the team hasn't followed, but I think back to the players only meeting they had after the Washington game, and they really wanted to go out and make a statement against Columbus that was so abundantly clear. And that was actually a pretty decent road game, despite the fact that they lost an OT, and Horvat was the one leading the way with two goals, kind of dragging the team into the fight. And that's, you know, you hear the cliche being thrown around of leading by example. Like that's literally what it looks like. And there were other moments last season under Boudreaux where he was catching fire and he'd come up with a clutch power play goal in the right moment to kind of swing the tide and swing the momentum. In the second period there, the team had unfortunately just dug itself too deep of a hole, but he gets on the board on the power play. And then he also works his ass off to draw that penalty in front of the net, forcing Siegenthaler into the box. That was the Canucks' chance where, again, if they had converted, that would have brought him back into the game. That was all Bo Horvat. So it's been impressive to see kind of the fight that he's put up, because after the first couple of games, we were kind of wondering like, geez, he really, really looks out of it. So the last 7-8 games have been outstanding for him. And on the power play, it's funny because every penalty killer on the league, every team is watching tape of the power play and they're going, we can't let Horvat get the puck of the bumper. That's the play they love to make. And Horvat has not only continued producing there, which by the way, the Canucks power play has crept into the top 5 of the NHL. It's ranked number 5 right now in terms of conversion rate. Obviously, they've let a couple back shorthanded, which has affected their overall goal differential, but that's been roaring again. And it's just impressive to me that he's continued getting his looks in the bumper. And in fact, his shot rate is the highest it's ever been on the power play. And I'm just thinking, how has he managed that? Considering everyone around the league knows that he's the guy in the middle that the Canucks just will continue to feed over and over and over again. And I think that speaks to his adaptability. On the first goal that he had, for example, it was interesting to kind of see him pop higher in the zone. And that's an adjustment where I think we've seen it with bumper players around the NHL where because penalty kills understand the importance of trying to take away the middle, sometimes a bumper will just kind of come higher up in the zone and take his looks there. And that's where Horvat sort of took his shot. I think it was right around the tops of the faceoff circles. And he's just become such a lethal finisher that even if he doesn't need to be right in the inner slot to finish those chances, if you give him an open look, even in the high slot, he's able to bury a lot of those. So that's been really impressive. And look, I get it. Some people have been saying, well, we need more out of him at 5-on-5. And sure, I think there hasn't been enough for this Canucks team when Elias Pettersson has been on the bench at 5-on-5. But You also look at his numbers, 6 goals for, 6 against at 5-on-5. Like, he hasn't been hurting the team at all from a 5-on-5 perspective, which is impressive considering two things. Number one, that the team around him has kind of been a tire fire. And number two, the fact that he started the season with Pearson and Besser. Like, I just thought that was such an odd fit. First of all, with Besser, because those two, outside of Besser's rookie season, they've been a suboptimal fit. The numbers bear it out. They've just never, Horvat and Besser, really clicked. And I looked at that line and went, there's not enough speed on the wings. And Horvat as a shot-first guy, there's just no playmaker. You're kind of putting Horvat in a tough spot, especially because Pearson's had a really, really rough go of it defensively at 5-on-5 in terms of driving play. And with Pearson kind of starting the way he did and Besser coming back really early from his preseason surgery, Horvat didn't have a lot of help at 5-on-5. So the fact that he maybe hasn't put up a ton of production at 5-on-5, I don't think that's on him. And he still has 3 goals at 5-on-5, which is second on this team behind Elias Pettersson. So he's, you know, his performance has definitely been really encouraging to see.
Take us through, though, the overall lack of strength or lack of even strength scoring right now, because, you know, they're getting some things done in the power play, but you'd think they'd be creating a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest surprise is, look, we had our question marks about the defense, but we looked at the top 9 group on paper and thought, this is a team that should be able to create chances, should be able to score a lot. And right now they're 27th in the league at 5-on-5 goals per 60. And it's not just the finishing. They're also bottom 5 in shots generated. They're having a tough time generating quality. And the biggest thing that stands out when I watch the team try and play at 5-on-5 is they're not, outside of the Pettersson line. The Pettersson line's kind of on an island in terms of being able to create offense off the rush. Every other line hasn't consistently this season been able to create chances in transition. They're having to grind and scratch and claw for every chance off the forecheck. And that's just, it's a really, really tough way of trying to create offense. You're just not having enough situations where your talented players outside of the Pettersson line have time and space and are able to generate speed and are able to kind of catch the opposition in situations where they're potentially vulnerable. Because in today's NHL, there's really two ways to kind of have defenses in scramble mode is, number one, you've got to be able to create turnovers off the forecheck, because there you're going to have, the opposition is going to have wingers and forwards that are out of position that were otherwise looking to support the breakout. And all of a sudden you've got a situation where you can catch the other team by surprise. The other sort of situation where you can catch defenses is off the counterattack, because otherwise opposing teams are just too smart at taking away the middle. They're just not going to give you a lot. And I think that's the concern that the Canucks have kind of run into. And when you look at, okay, individually, where is the team kind of falling short? Again, I really don't want to bag on Miller, but he's only got 2 5-on-5 points, 0 5-on-5 assists. And sometimes when a star player is struggling to produce, you look at the underlying numbers and say, okay, maybe he's just been snake bitten. But with Miller right now, it's just he doesn't even look dangerous consistently enough. I mean, the Pittsburgh game, outside of that, which I thought in that game was by far his best one of the season, he doesn't look dangerous enough creating chances. And you look at his on-ice shots for rate, right? We've talked about the defensive struggles. We know they've been there. And obviously, I think he's been better in that respect since he shifted over to the wing. Problem is, there's also been nothing to show for it 5-on-5 offensively. Miller's on-ice shots for rate, the only Canucks forwards who are generating those shots at a lower rate than him right now are Oman and Joshua. Those guys definitely aren't paid to produce offense. So I think that's been part of it is man,
that is huge.
There's just been not enough there. And that's a big part of the reason why when Pettersson's off the bench, the teams are really, it looks like they're really trudging uphill trying to create anything. And in that first period, like that's a perfect example too against the Devils where, okay, you have zone time, you have possession, you're playing an excellent defensive game. But, and they had some shots, but in terms of grade A chances, I felt that there wasn't enough. And I think that's I think the biggest concern in terms of where the team's playing relative to expectations, because the top line should be a strength of this team right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue. And like there were certain things you knew were going to be a problem. There are certain things you had different expectations for. Certainly, we all thought Thatcher Demko would be playing at a higher level right now. But we did think 5-on-5 scoring wasn't going to be a problem for this team. And look, you're right that so much of scoring is connected to connected play and being able to get the puck in transitions and in good positions to generate offense. But you do get the puck from time to time down in the offensive zone, and you've got to be able to generate a little bit more. And they just simply haven't found a way to do that. So, again, fragile group. And sometimes, you know, a lot of teams will lean on their on their special teams success or their power play scoring to get some confidence with their 5-on-5 play. And we're just not seeing that right now from a lot of the top players, not named Horvat and Pedersen.
Yeah, and the power play's gotten going, which is a necessary ingredient when you're not killing it at 5-on-5, but it's just the penalty kill continues to undermine them. And that's the part of the roster or just the team where if they can't fix that, nothing else kind of matters. If you're going to be the worst team in the league at killing penalties, you've got to be an elite 5-on-5 team, and the Canucks in order to kind of make up for that. And that's where it's like when the penalty kill's that bad, you can be one of the best power plays in the league. All you're doing is making up the ground that you're otherwise kind of digging yourself a hole for.
Well, and they've given up 3 shorthanded goals.
Yeah.
So that hasn't helped them. But think about it last year, like even under Travis Green, when that penalty killing was horrendous, the storyline daily was if we could just keep the game 5-on-5, we're great. Well, right now they're not great 5-on-5. So, and as we wrap this up, we saw the New Jersey Devils and we knew that this was going to be a dangerous team for the Canucks given their speed and the Canucks' lack of it. Next two opponents coming up, the Anaheim Mighty Ducks and the Nashville Predators, both of whom are just a point ahead of Vancouver in the standings. They have both teams are 3-6-1 through 10 games, sitting on 7 points. The Canucks are punching at their weight class right now for the next two games. They better come out of this with 4 points.
Needed, especially going into that Eastern Conference road trip. It's not going to be easy. They've got, I'm looking at the schedule now. It's not too bad in terms of the teams that they play, especially with with the Leafs spiraling. Which
who's making that road trip? Is it you or Drancer?
It's Drancer,
of course, because it ends in Toronto, or it's in the middle of that trip is in Toronto. So he's going to make that trip.
Well, I get Edmonton every year. So
why would you want that?
I don't want it, but it's the cost that I've kind of had to play. I mean, I can't complain. After last season, I had Vegas twice. I had New York for a week. Like, that's fine. If he wants Toronto, I've gotten Toronto the last few times. So, if Drancer wants to feel at home, I'll definitely oblige. But yeah, I mean, they've got to win these, like, I feel like a broken record.
Yeah, they have to win these next two games. They can't be giving up points in these two games. Especially a team
like Nashville. Like, that's a team where they could conceivably still find it, and you've got to bury them. Like, that's almost a 4-point game in terms of, and I know it's early, but that's the sort of team the Canucks are going to be contending with probably if they want to get back into the wildcard race. So you've got to, it's especially important to put the Preds away at a time where they're vulnerable. And when UC Saros, kind of similar to Demko right now, hasn't been at his best. And by the way, there you go. Another example of, hey, an elite goaltender, you're going to get those peaks and valleys. And if your entire team is built off of an elite goalie playing like a top 5 netminder, you're not going to be able to survive the lows, and that shows flawed roster construction. There's another example in Nashville of that exact same dynamic. You've got to take advantage of Nashville, their top players not looking like their top players, and the Ducks, they just don't have enough top-end offensive weapons outside of Trevor Zegras to really threaten and their defense right now, especially with Jamie Drysdale out, John Klingberg looking like he's in a state of disarray. You've got to be able to take advantage of their blue line and start to generate some even strength chances and some offense there.
Yeah, absolutely. And when, you know, when we look at this,
especially Kevin Bieksa-Knight, like,
that's right. Like,
you're gonna have some energy in the building. Have some pride. Like, show up for your
Maybe
fans.
Maybe you should go address the team in the locker room and
fire them up.
Fire up the boys with one of his witty stories.
Kill penalty.
Yeah. Do his Vern Fiddler face. Break up, you know. Actually, no, it's Vern Fiddler doing his face. Maybe we should just bring in Vern Fiddler. That might be more music. But yeah, like, it's, they need something. They need something. But, you know, before we go, like, we were talking about this off air before we started, just, I'm always amused at the angst in the Toronto media. I mean, like, Sheldon Keefe could get fired before Bruce Boudreaux. And think of, it's just, I mean, it's all about expectations, because the Canucks would love the Leafs record right now. And I go back to when the Leafs were, you know, horrendous for a decade, much like the Canucks feel like they have been now. And you look at, you know, where the Leafs, when the Leafs were coming into town, and I remember when Ron Wilson was the coach, and the Canucks just destroyed the Leafs. Like, I want to say the score was 6-0 or 6-1 in the game. And at the end of it, the Leafs TV reporter, Paul, what was Paul's last name again? Why am I having a brain cramp?
I don't know. I'm too young for this.
Anyway, recently retired Leafs TV reporter, a fabulous guy. And he's Paul Hendrick, and he starts in with, "Hey, yeah, that third period was a little bit better, wasn't it?" And Ron Wilson just looked at him like he was crazy. But you can't just keep harping on the negative over and over and over. And ultimately, it's Leafs TV, so they've got to try to spin it positive. But expectations are a funny thing, and we would love to be in a situation where we could cover a team that had a different level of expectation. Certainly, the expectation was a little bit different than what we're seeing to this point, but it's basically in line with what we've seen for the better part of the last 7 or 8 years. So we'll see if they can turn it around before our next episode. Meanwhile, if you're looking for other pod options, Don Granato of the Buffalo Sabres joined Craig Custance and Sean Gentile on the Athletic Hockey Show. So try to tune into that if you've got some time. Also, Hillary Knight stops by the Friday edition of the Athletic Hockey Show with Haley Salvian and Sean Gentile. As for us, you can subscribe to the Athletic's NHL YouTube channel, youtube.com/The Athletic Hockey Show, and also follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Leave a rating and a review. You can also get annual subscriptions to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/vancast. That's it for Harm and I. We'll be back next week, hopefully a few wins later, as we get set for the Canucks road trip through Canada. And I think Harm is still going to be in his early 20s at that point.
I mean, with the way this team is aging, yeah, I don't know anymore.
See you next week.